Hi, my name's Pete Knapp, an air quality PhD student at Imperial College London. This series of podcasts is kindly promoted by the Grantham Institute, the college's hub for climate change and environment. Subscribe to receive future episodes and contact the Grantham Institute on Twitter with @Grantham_IC and me with @PeteK_AQ. This is Tipping Points, a podcast featuring interviews with people who've become environmental activists. What made them change? What are they doing now? And what do they hope to see in the future as we face possible breakdown of civilization and life on Earth? This first series focuses on scientists in the UK. Me in this episode is Dr. Caroline Vincent from London. Welcome.
Thank you, Pete. Thanks.
Caroline, I'd like to hear your life story, if you can, in 3 minutes.
I had a very happy childhood where my parents were letting me roaming free in the countryside. And so I was a type of child who'd take a bicycle and go in the forest to forage for mushroom or look for frog spawn in lakes. And I decided that I wanted to work, not working at a desk. So I did an agriculture degree and then went into research. When I did my postdoc in Cambridge, that I realized that research was not really for me. So I did an MBA and went for my sin, I went into business. And this is where I spent most of my career, basically building forecasting system for the pharmaceutical industry. But I was not really happy there working for other people. So I started my own business. And for nearly 20 years, this is what I did for different pharmaceuticals around the world. Until I stumbled across Extinction Rebellion 2 years ago. I ended up winding down my business to dedicate myself to the climate and ecological emergency, really. And the trigger for that was really, like most of people who joined Extinction Rebellion, it was the reading of the IPCC report at the end of 2018, which really looked at what 1.5 versus 2 degree meant. And I remember reading an article in The Guardian or the BBC about it and was really puzzled. So I decided to dig out more articles about it and look directly at the IPCC report. And I was horrified. Horrified by what I found. And I just couldn't really believe it. So I went from an awareness that we were in trouble, but, you know, an awareness and yes, we're in trouble, but people are taking care of it, to how is this possible? My immediate reaction was like, I wanted to shout it from the top of the roof and saying, hey, wake up, everybody. I mean, this is what I've just discovered. Do you realize the trouble we are in? So I didn't really have time for grief or anything. I just transformed my, I don't know, my discovery into manic action. You know, being a scientist, you think, okay, if you tell people facts, they are going to understand and they are going to integrate and react. But it doesn't work. And it took me quite a while to realize that. You know, I was involved with a few friends telling people about recycling and educating people about different type of plastics. But I thought, well, you know, I really, really, really need to really focus on the essentials. So I went to a Greenpeace meeting and then they were suggesting, you know, action like standing in front of supermarket and wrapping plastics. And I thought, just, this is not what we need to do, guys. I'm sorry, but we passed this, you know. And they looked at me like if I was a bit mad, except somebody called Abby, I remember, took me aside and said, you don't belong here. You should go to see Extinction Rebellion. Sorry, who are they? And so she told me and I said, oh, yeah, they are the nutcases who stand up in front of Downing Street telling the government they were in rebellion. I thought, really? And Abby said, well, you should look them up. So I went back home and read and read and read about Extinction Rebellion, watched hours of videos. And I just thought, this all makes sense. That's what I need to do.
You joined Extinction Rebellion when it was fairly small, presumably.
Yes, yes. I crossed London to go to an induction session. And it was Roger Allam, actually, who was doing loads of those sessions at the time, sitting on a cold bench with, you know, 10 other people and having the opportunity to ask questions about Extinction Rebellion and talk to my husband. And then the next step was to drag my husband along to another Extinction Rebellion event. Because when I told him about it, he was like, wow, what's this? And I said, well, you need to hear them. You need to hear those guys. And I dragged him to this event and he said, yeah, you should join. I turned up one day in the office of Extinction Rebellion and said, give me something to do. It was before we had XR Scientist.
Were you at that stage effectively a scientific advisor? Were you helping to vet the science?
Well, yes and no. At the time, there was only one other scientist who was really with the credential to talk about the climate and the ecology. So I was supporting a lot of actions by doing peer-reviewed journal research with bullet points to help actions. But when it came to writing down scientific reasoning why Extinction Rebellion exists, I had to rely on that person to check what I was writing. And together with two other people, we put together the first emergency page on the website. I mean, we had 3 days to do this before the April Rebellion, and it was pretty manic. But it was quite difficult for me because I had to really understand try to understand the climate science, but I didn't want to betray it. So I was relying on that person who knew what he was doing to help me and to check everything I was writing.
It's one of those really difficult things to do, especially when it's not your area, but to take something incredibly complicated and convoluted to simplify it in a way that doesn't oversimplify and, in fact, give the wrong message.
That's right. The translation of complicated science is definitely a skill that doesn't come natural to me, and I'm not very good at it. But at the time, this is all we had. So when I was talking to scientists around me, I thought it would be very difficult to get them on board with Extinction Rebellion. To my surprise, I saw a lot of scientists joining Extinction Rebellion in October. I saw this tent set up by people who were calling themselves at the time scientists for XR. And I burst into tears because I was so happy to see so many scientists joining XR. I just couldn't believe it.
That must have been a wonderful feeling, yeah, to see suddenly a load of kindred spirits all in one place.
It was wonderful.
What was it like in your first protest, if you remember when that was?
To be honest with you, it was really nerve-wracking because we were setting ourselves to really wake up London and the UK. And we had no idea how many people would join. I remember turning up on Marble Arch with a flag and thinking, how many people are we going to be? I was terrified that there will be 20 people on each side and then the police will arrive. And you turn up with your flags and you see a few familiar faces and you think, okay, but those are my friends. Okay, so how many people are going to turn up now? And then suddenly, more and more people turning up, more and more people were turning up. And it was like, oh God, all those people are thinking like me. This is wonderful. It was one of the best days of my life.
And presumably there was a moment when the media started to report about this and the media could take it one of two ways, right? It could say it could be in support of the protests or it could be against it.
Yes.
And what was your emotional response to reading the headlines?
Oh, that it was wonderful. It was wonderful because I remember an interview of a taxi driver who said, well, yeah, it's really inconvenient, but they've got a point. The parliament declared a climate emergency in May. Our protests were in April. It's not coincidental. It is because of Extinction Rebellion and people, and I'm not writing history there. I mean, everybody wanted to talk to Extinction Rebellion.
And at some point, you were involved in an arrestable protest. Tell me more about that.
In April, it was on Waterloo Bridge, and it was not where I was supposed to be that day. I was with a friend, and we were going from one site to another. And we arrived on Waterloo Bridge, and there were a lot of young people on one side of the bridge, ended up talking to other young people. And at one point, we realized that the police were coming in force to clear the bridge. They had tried during the night, but didn't manage. They were coming back to clear the bridge. And a lot of young people started sitting down, so I sat down with them. And I realized, talking to them, that most of them had not done any nonviolent direct action training. They had no idea what it meant to be arrested. And one elderly woman stood up and said, right, we're not going to let those young people getting arrested. Let's go in the front. And I thought, well, okay, let's do that. So I joined the group of older women in the front. Yeah, I was sure I would get arrested. In my mind, you are never totally prepared, but in my mind, I had done the preparation. And if I prevented by my arrest a young person to be arrested, the better. That's my view.
Yeah. And so was it at that point or was it before that point you became the police liaison officer of sorts?
Oh, much after that. At that stage, I actually didn't know how to talk to the police at all. When you get arrested, it doesn't matter how you psychologically you are prepared. Your heart is pumping. So the police comes to arrest you and speak to you. And it was total chaos. So I couldn't hear what they were saying. But I decided to walk because I was absolutely terrified that they will drop me if they carry me. One of the tactics of Extinction Rebellion, which is in line with nonviolent direct action, is to go floppy and let the police carry you. I was terrified that they would drop me. And apparently, which I can't remember, I was giving the police a lot of stats about the IPCC report as I was walked away, which really makes me laugh now. Because it's really not the way to convince people that what you are doing is the right thing. But I took this opportunity to ask them if they are children, you know, if they were concerned about the climate.
What was their response to your questions about this? Were any of the police sympathetic?
Yes. So that's the fascinating things, because they are there to do a job, and most of them, you know, for most of them, it's another protest. They don't even want to know what the protest is about. But some of them respond quite well because they want to know a little bit more, or they want to talk to you about their own anxiety about it. And that's the fascinating thing. They are the police, but they are also human beings. They've got children. My arresting officer, I told them not to engage with me anymore because he said I was here to brainwash them, which I thought was quite funny. And that's why I joined the police liaison group. We can make a difference in the way the police sees us if we start engaging with them. And we were successful to a certain extent for a long time engaging with the police. The tone has changed a little bit because of Priti Patel and the way she wants to label us as an organized crime group. I found it fascinating that the police wanted to know more about Extinction Rebellion and that we were able at one point to engage quite successfully with them.
Do you see an XR police group happening?
Oh, there is. There is an XR police group, and a few of them have been arrested, actually. And there is a wonderful video about it. I've worked with two ex-policemen who are pillars of the police liaison group and trained a lot of police liaison people in XR. And I spoke to, well, at least two police officers who told me that on retirement they will join XR. Yeah, when I said XR has got a lot of people from all walks of life, it's really true, yeah.
And why do you think that Priti Patel wants to label XR as a crime group?
Because I don't think she's got any understanding at all of the climate and ecological crisis. I don't think she's a very intelligent person. And I think that for her, the priority number one is efficiency of her department. She sees us as a real disturbance because we've been successful in the way we were protesting. The only way that she can basically put us back in the box would be if she could manage to label us as an organized crime group, which is ironic, really, because she should look back at the definition of a crime. If anybody should be labeled as criminal, it's the people who are not acting.
You've raised awareness and you've put this climate and ecological emergency onto the agenda of the politicians. Is that job done?
Yeah, you would think so. The public opinion of Extinction Rebellion and the opinion of the media shifted slightly. But I think people forget, yes, the government is doing something about it, right? So they keep telling us that we are leading the world in terms of climate action. So people say, well, job done. Yes, Extinction Rebellion, you've raised the alarm, right? The parliament has declared climate emergency. The government now is hosting COP26. Extinction Rebellion, you are no more needed. Thank you very much. Well, the thing people do not understand is that the government is not doing enough, and we shouldn't listen to them telling us that we are leading the world, because we are not. We need to educate people. We need to make people understand that what the government is doing is not enough. And the media is not helping. Well, most of the media are not helping.
How is best to raise this message?
Well, I think this is where scientists have got a role to play in explaining to people that the government is not doing enough. Most of us are perfectly happy to talk to total strangers on the street, distributing leaflets and telling them that we are in a crisis and we need to do something about it. But most of us find it really difficult to have that conversation with with our own family and with our friends. And I found myself exactly in that situation.
Tell me more about these difficult conversations. Where did they start and how did they develop?
I think it's hard to talk to your friends about the climate and ecological crisis because you fear you are going to be disappointed. You don't want to carry on banging on about it because then people switch off. The conversation 5 minutes later is about their latest holidays and what they are going to do and the flight that they are going to take. You thinking, well, did you just listen to what I've just said? So I'm not having those conversations anymore because I'm thinking, well, you know, I love you and I don't want to be disappointed. So I prefer to not to talk to you about it, which is really a shame because I ended up not seeing friends that are my friends for years because I don't have a lot in common with them anymore. I found it painful to realize that they have absolutely no awareness of what's going on. I mean, the other thing that you find quite commonly is that some people are curious. Oh, so you're part of Extinction Rebellion. Tell me more about it. You talk to them a little bit, and then their immediate answer is like, oh, yes, you are right, you know. What really gets me is the way the council is not organizing the recycling in the right way. And you just look at them and thinking, sorry, you know, I'm talking about existential crisis here. I'm talking about potential war. And you are talking to me about the recycling. Are we on the same planet? Those conversations are very, very difficult to have. Yeah.
What would your old friends then say about you? Would they say you were sensationalist or provocative, maybe?
Oh, you know, Caroline, when she does something, she really goes over the top. So I've heard that. Oh, yeah, good for you, but you know, it's not for everybody. A lot of people think that, you know, if they stop eating meat, which is great, if they start recycling, the problem is going to be solved. The problem will not get solved until we've got systemic change. It is necessary, but it's not enough. And my husband often says, oh, Caroline, you know, everybody's on their own journey and some people are slower than others, but we don't have time. We can't wait for you to realize this in 10 years. We don't have time.
Yeah. So do you think that protests are the way forward, or are the days of protests over?
No, protests are definitely necessary. I mean, people will not engage unless they are disturbed a little bit. I think it's a fine balance between totally disturbing people, but you need to provoke a thought process. You need to. One example is that now I'm not flying anymore. So now I'm refusing to go on holiday or join friends for a weekend. If we want a weekend together as a group of friends, well, let's do it in France where I can join you by train, or not do it at all, or do it in the UK. But I'm not joining you for a weekend in Barcelona. This is just out of question. So their first reaction is like, oh, you are a pain in the backside with your climate. But then you provoke a thought because that night you can be sure that they're going to think about it and think, well, you know, she loves us dearly, but the fact that she doesn't want to join us because of the climate might mean something. And I think it's the same for organized protests. Yes, we are going to disturb for a few hours the life of people. It's inconvenient that they stay in a traffic jam for a few hours. But if we do it in a clever way, people will think about it.
And you also got involved with the train talks to spread the message to people on the trains and make them feel a little uncomfortable in the process. How did that work, and were there any difficult situations that came up from that?
It's interesting because I watched a train talk given by Jade, who is a teacher. I thought it was very inspirational. So I thought, oh, this is something that XR scientists could do. That would be brilliant, right? All bunch of scientists on a train talking to strangers. And so I contacted Jade and I said, you know, can we organize a training? And that would be great. And she said, yes, but it's all very well, Colin, but you know, you can't organize a training if you have not given a talk. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't give talks. And she said, no. I said, no, I'm not kidding. You can't organize a train talk training if you have not done a train talk yourself. So she took me to do a train talk and I thought I'll die. You stand up on the train and for 1 minute you've got to say something to people. And the first time I did it, my legs were shaking so much that I needed to hold the bar to support myself. I was explaining to them that climate change was not about dying polar bears. And then I did it again and it was now, we were now in full COVID crisis. And the third time, it was very difficult because I realized that the public was now engaged into other problems. And a few people said, yes, but you know, at the moment, my head is not around this. I've got bigger problem to deal with. And you could tell that people were not receptive. Let's not forget that the people who would have been on public transport at that time would be people who really needed to be on public transport and probably facing tons of problems at work and with COVID-19. So I decided to stop at that stage. It doesn't mean that I would never do it again because there were a few times where I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Some people would argue then that protesting on trains is not the best place because it's a relatively clean way to get around. So surely you're preaching to the converted there.
Yes and no, because you talk to them about other things, you see. Jed is very inspirational when she gives the talk. She talked about the fact that she was an oil engineer and she gave it up to be a school teacher and that now she's worried about the kids.
You said that she was an engineer, did you say?
Yeah, she was an oil and gas engineer. Yeah, and she gave it all up to be a teacher. So when she gives the talk about the climate and ecological crisis, you can see people switch off and go back to their books. Sorry, to their mobile. She says, you know, I used to be an oil and gas engineer and I've given it all up when I realized what I was doing. Then people raise their eyes, I mean, you know, and start listening. They think, why did she do that?
You've been involved in so many projects with XR and working as much as you've done with XR can lead to burnout. And you've recently needed a bit of time off. Why was it that you needed that?
I had my fingers in too many pots. So, you know, I will start the day at 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night. And God knows what I was doing during those days, but doing bits and pieces and not very efficiently. I was starting letting people down and I was more and more depressed about the state of the world. So I needed to take time off. For one piece of good news that you read, there are 10 pieces of bad news. The fires are destroying the ecosystem, the glaciers that are melting. It's bad news after bad news after bad news. There is so much you can take at one point. Not that I'm not reading anymore, but not with a systematic way that I was doing it, you know, reading everything. And I think it's a disease that I've got where when I do something, yeah, I do it 110%. And, it, you know, after 2 years, it took its toll.
Well, XR seems to have attracted people with that mindset because I think it's people who focus so much discover the breadth and the depth of the problem. And this is a danger, isn't it? That when you raise people's awareness of this crisis, without the tools of dealing with the grief and the depression, that's got to be a danger, hasn't it?
Absolutely. You are totally right. And you've got to protect yourself. You've got not to take too much on. You've got to be able to deal with the grief. You've got to be able to function. And doing more and more is not the solution.
In your case, you work really hard until you hit a point where you say, I'm going to take some time off. Do you then, during that time, completely disengage?
Well, I haven't really managed to disengage completely. I'm trying not to do too much. I've started a permaculture course, which I found fascinating. For me, permaculture is gardening the way nature intended. It's growing things with minimum intervention because one of the principles of permaculture is that you don't dig the earth and you don't add any chemical fertilizers because, of course, the bacteria and the worms and the fungi in the soil do their own thing. And having all the time a place for nature in your garden. So even if it's a small garden, it could just be, you know, the top of the tree that you never interact with in order to let a little bit of nature thrive in your garden. So it's absolutely fascinating because, you know, my first degree was in agriculture and it was a long, long time ago. I mean, it was around 38 years ago where you learned, you know, how to plow fields and throw as much fertilizer as you could and all of this. And of course, this is absolutely the wrong way to go about it. So I've got to unlearn everything that I've learned, not that I've, you know, I've probably forgotten it all.
How do you feed yourself? Do you go to supermarkets and do the normal thing or have you found an alternative?
I go to a farmer's market. I do that once a week and I don't eat meat anymore. I still eat dairy, but no cheese. I try to cut down on dairy too.
But then surely if the message is raised to people from low socioeconomic backgrounds about the effect of buying food from supermarkets with fertilizers and pesticides and so on, they're often the cheapest foods. So
you're right. And that's why we need changes at the top level. Of course, people on low income are going to go to supermarket and buy food with pesticide, and that's not the way it should be. it shouldn't be an individual choice because, as you pointed out, I'm privileged, so I can go to a farmer's market, but a lot of people can't. Our duty is to provide people with food they can afford without destroying the natural world.
That's a very good point. And it's something that I think is often forgotten in protests that attempts to raise awareness, but without giving the tools to really necessarily do anything about it. But just to be aware of something without the ability to change your own individual behaviour can sometimes result in some quite severe guilt.
You're totally right.
What would you say to people who feel that they can't change their individual behaviour, but know that what they're doing is not helping things?
Where I'm less forgiving is when people can change and don't change. We need to be aware that a lot of people can't change. They don't have the choice. Individual change, I'm not going to cut the mustard.
What do you think about Bill Gates' efforts then?
Oh, don't start on that. Don't start me on Bill Gates. I was horrified because suddenly we were confronted by a billionaire who was congratulating himself because he uses biofuel to use his jets. Technology is going to save the day. We were confronted with somebody who was, I think, talking down to people and criticizing, you know, okay, criticize Extinction Rebellion, but how dare you criticize the kids for being on strike, right? It's their future. I think it just shows how out of touch he is with the reality of the crisis.
If you were a billionaire, then how would you do things differently?
That's a good question. I will try to influence government in different countries. I'm not saying he's doing bad things because he's doing a lot of good things, but on the climate and ecological crisis, I think he should use his money to try to lobby government, but not to invest in technology, but, you know, to stop burning fossil fuel. And yeah, that's how I will use my money.
Final question then. What will you hope to see change before the end of the year? What kind of systemic changes?
In the UK, the country is totally depleted. We've killed nature, and this is where I would really like to see the government acting. Supporting the farmers to do the right things. There is a bill going through, but it's not enough. One good example is the recent use of neonicotinoids that they allowed farmers to use on beets.
Just to clarify here, that beets are used to produce sugar.
Yes, beets are used to produce sugar, that's right. And yields were coming down because of parasites that developed mainly due to climate change, the fact that the climate is changing. So, you know, for a lot of cultures, we've got now new form of disease or insect that develop more and more. So that's the case for the beets. So suddenly the beets yield were decreasing. And what is the solution? Well, let's turn to neonicotinoids, which have been banned for many years because of their detrimental effect on bees. So on one hand, you've got a problem that occurs because of climate change. And who is going to be affected by your response? Now you are going to destroy nature in your response to fix the problems that occur because of climate change. I mean, it's unbelievable. What we need is to support farmers and to give them the tools and the money to adapt. We need also to look at how we're going to feed ourselves, because at the moment, I think we import nearly 50% of our food. So let's grow back the food we need in the way that's not destroying nature.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion. And Dr. Caroline Vincent, thank you.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks. It was a pleasure talking to you, as usual.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project. We communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.